a number of challenges. Because of low barriers of entry in the taxi industry, it was being overflooded. And we have good reason to suspect it was also a strategic thing to create violence amongst blacks that were entrepreneurs. At the time, we know that in around 1959, for example, the government of the day then decided to subsidize buses with the exclusion of taxis, which is a legacy that we're still living with, Madam Chair. And I'm sure when I deal with some of the points here, we are really aggrieved as a taxi industry that in a transformed democracy that we are 20 years, we're still living with some legacies of apartheid as this industry. We are being excluded from that platform of subsidy. But it's not about us, but the millions of commuters that use taxis every day are being excluded from the subsidy net. And I think it's one of the unfortunate consequences of the sunset clauses that were actually agreed upon. We're still suffering those, some of us. And I think we hope that we know the committee might not be directly involved in transport, but that these issues could find some support from various quarters. Labour is here, that millions of workers, and I think the two household surveys, Madam Chair, that have come out have clearly shown that it cost about 40 to 50% of workers' income to access public transport. So if, Madam Chair, you want to deal with issues of poverty, inequality, etc., if these commuters could be subsidized, it will leave them with quite a lot of money in their pocket to deal with poverty issues and other things that might be of critical importance. Now, in terms of how SANTACO was formed, was to try to unite the taxi industry. There were many structures. I think at the time there were about 40-odd organizations representing taxi operators. Then late Minister Dala Omar then led a process that was to try to unite all these bodies, because government felt at the time they couldn't deal with 40 different structures. So they wanted them to come together to form one body. So there was a long process, including to assess what were the challenges facing the taxi industry. We know at the time one of those was violence. There was the industry was not professionalized, unregulated, etc. So the National Taxi Task Team came out with a number of recommendations. One of them was to form a unitary body that will represent the taxi industry. Indeed, in 2001, it culminated to the launch or the formation of SANTACO. As it always happens, unfortunately, immediately after that conference, there was breakaways, as it will always happen. Those who are unsuccessful in an election process can either support or break away. So as it stands in the country, you have two major bodies. We are the only government-recognized body, and we are comfortably representing over 90% of taxi operators in the country. Okay, I've dealt with that. Now, just to share maybe some of the statistical information that might be of interest. We have over 100,000 members. Now, I know we're sitting here representing members who are the taxi owners, and indeed indirectly or directly employers of taxi drivers, and indirectly employers of queue marshals and other people involved in the taxi operation. But at the same time, the taxi industry itself, from a labor point of view, workers are not organized. And I think it's an opportunity that unions in that space might have missed. But we also understand drivers are of a different caliber, and it might have been difficult to organize in that space. So at SANTACO, we have always played a role of representing our members, but also representing the interest of the workers or the drivers within the taxi industry. So the 100,000 I'm talking about, it only reflects to the taxi owners. And like I said, we represent over 90% of the taxi operators. We are correctly, if you want to talk about BEE, you can't find any better BEE than the taxi industry. Other than SOCA, I think we take claim to that. I think that we are the most BEE conscious body. And yes, SANTACO is the only government recognized, and I think we have worked with government in a number of engagements. We are democratic, we believe, Madam Chair. We have elections every 4 years. Since 2001, we have had successful elections. So our leadership is democratically elected, and we subscribe to corporate governance, etc. We are accountable. Like I said, we have a 65% market share. And I think what is interesting, Madam Chair, we transport about 15 million commuters on a daily basis. And that is mostly our workforce. We contribute about 3.4% to the GDP. Those are the last figures we checked. We employ about over 600,000 people within the taxi industry. So that includes your taxi drivers, your queue marshals, people at taxi rank who are cleaning, etc. So we believe it's quite a huge contribution in a country with such a huge unemployment rate. We have a fleet of about over 200,000 taxis, and I think it's on an average of about 2 taxis per member. So others will have 10 taxis, others 50, and others 1 taxi. So we came to an average of about 2 taxis. Our fleet, Madam Chair, is valued at about 18 billion. So if you look at the number of cars and exactly how much they are, we have a buying power of almost about 35 to 40 billion per annum. And we spend all this money on these various aspects, fuel, insurance, tires, manufacturing, vehicle maintenance, lubricant, labor cost, vehicle financing, etc. Now, given the challenges that the industry has faced over years, we took a conscious decision that we, as a tax industry, as leadership of the industry, we need to transform the tax industry, and we can't rely on anyone to do it. At the time, we crafted a strategy called the TR3 2020. So T means taxi, and there's 3 R's, which means redefine, restructure, and reposition. And I think the idea was that by year 2020, we wanted to have redefined ourselves as a taxi industry, not to be seen in a negative perception that we were seen. We had agreed that we'll have to restructure how we actually operate and position ourselves as a strategic partner in the provision of public transport. Madam Chair, I must say, from 2010, we've seen quite a number of developments within the taxi industry, and we believe we're in the right track to achieve our goal by year 2020. We always revise these goals annually to see that we are making the necessary progress. If you look at how we want to reposition ourselves, we see ourselves not only as taxi operators, but as transport operators. So we want to move away from being purely taxi operators, but to play in the broader public transport space. I've shown before that we spend about 35 to 40 billion per annum, but that has placed us purely as a consumer. So we spend this money and we do not benefit in that value chain. So we want to change that again so that we become a shareholder in this business, not just a consumer. Indeed, as we are sitting here, we see ourselves as a contributor to decision making. And I think in terms of approach, we're moving away from a reactive approach where we are seen on the street more, but rather to sit around these tables and raise issues and actually debate them and actually allow democratic processes to actually take us forward. Madam Chair, just briefly to share some of the projects that we have worked on since the launch of our strategy. We've done a lot, but we highlighted some of the flagship projects. One of those is the Hlokomela campaign, which, as you know, in the past there have been quite a substantial number of taxi-related accidents. And I think one of the problems with those is that a taxi accident will involve many, many commuters, and therefore we felt as an industry we needed to play a role around a reduction of taxi accidents. And we know that the country at the time, it also signed with the United Nations that in the next 10 years would have half the accidents on our roads. And I think at this time we are about, from the work we've done, at about 30% a reduction. So you will notice during festive season that taxi accidents are not as high as they used to be. So there's quite a lot of work that goes into this campaign to check taxis, to make sure that the drivers are of good quality. We inspect vehicles to make sure that cars are being driven of such quality that they can avoid accidents. There's still problems in that space, Madam Chair. I'm sure you'll see on the road there's old taxis that are still driving around. Government did what we call taxi recapitalization program. But we've been debating that it has not been a success that we thought it will be. So there's still space to improve on this area. We are also a socially responsible organization, so we contribute quite a lot of money into social responsible projects and supporting different structures. The other critical thing we've done, we established a training, the first taxi training academy in 2011, which is located in Welkom in the Free State. And through that academy, we've trained quite a number of drivers, and I think the work continues to train drivers, queue marshals, etc. And again, it's all this aimed at trying to formalize and professionalize the taxi industry. So there's quite a lot of work that we are doing around that space. In the academy, we've got people supporting us, but also we do put our own resources as an organization to make sure that we provide training. We have recently brought a free Wi-Fi into the taxi fold to allow taxi commuters to access broadband and access the internet. And like we've said, we're transporting predominantly people from poorer communities who have no access to some of these resources. So we take a lot of pride in those projects that we are able to achieve. We have what we call Sandako Green, and I think is a big project or program aimed at contributing towards environmentally friendly public transport. In that instance, we are converting taxis to use gas, natural gas instead of fuel, to reduce the carbon footprint. We'll be launching some of them in October or November, around there. But I think it's one of our contributions towards ensuring that there's a healthier living environment, and so that future generations find a workable country. As you know, we have, like I said, a 200,000-odd fleet of taxis, so you can imagine the kind of emissions that will come out of that environment. So we believe we are, it's a good cause, Madam Chair. We're also driving an industrialization program where we want to see the manufacturing of taxis being done locally. We know currently the major players in this industry are multinationals that probably come here and sell taxis and export the money outside. So we want to keep the money home. So we are working on establishing a plant that will manufacture taxis locally, but also other parts within the environment, so that we create jobs, but also ensure that the economy grows, because currently we're in an economy of consumers, and I think that is not useful for trying to grow the economy. Madam Chair, I've dealt earlier with the issue of public transport subsidy. We have indeed made it a project, because like I'm saying, we're sitting here millions of taxi operators are not being subsidized. And in fact, we have moved away. We're saying to government, do not subsidize us as operators, but give the commuters the money. Then they can choose. If they choose to use a bus, they can go into a bus. If they choose to use the HAL train, they can do it. And Madam Chair, you'll be surprised that, or maybe not surprised, it could be public information that commuters that are using the HAL train are subsidized. And predominantly, they are not poor people. But poor people are not subsidized. And I think we find it, this has been a huge misnomer. And I think we really are ashamed that our government is continuing to support and perpetuate apartheid laws. And I think, Madam Chair, we have had a number of discussions with various platforms. We have come to portfolio committees, we have come to parliament, we have spoken to ministers after ministers. And there's always been a promise that, no, we all agree this thing is not right, it should be resolved. We are at a point where really, Madam Chair, we are going to be taking drastic steps to try to resolve this matter, including, which we find very disruptive to a country that needs to be working, to be in courts, to be in strikes, etc. But we think maybe that's how people tend to react if we end up in courts and in strike action. But I mean, Madam Chair, I think we'll see a number of activities in the near future to try to get this matter resolved. Because I think talking about it has kind of not yielded any positive results. But again, we want to invite all those who are interested to or who claim to represent the millions of workers and poor communities that if we can resolve this aspect, it will create quite a huge positive step in terms of the lives of our people. The other aspect that we are seriously engaging on is economic empowerment. Like I'm saying, Madam Chair, we spend about 40 billion and of that we do not benefit. That money purely sits in the hand of white capital, and I think we're taking a strong stance that we cannot continue to enrich other people while tax operators remain very poor. If you know in the townships, people in the past that used to be well-off, shop owners, taxi bosses, etc. It has changed. Taxi bosses are very poor. And that's why you see there's a lot of violence. If there's a new mall, they fight over that route. It is inherently because of their condition. And I think it is the same analogy. You can look at crime, that until we resolve issues of unemployment, you can employ as many police as you like, but when people are poor and hungry, they tend to find creative ways to deal with those problems. So I think we are at the point where we are saying to our partners in business that let's work together. Otherwise, we will have to take these businesses back to our own control. Now, just to zero in into the subject at hand, Madam Chair, we, as an industry, have been engaged throughout the process of the negotiations around the basic condition of employment, sectoral determination, etc. And I think we've worked very, very well with the Department of Labor. I must say, though, that it varies different administration or different leaders in the department who have a different appetite to engage with the tax industry. There were times where there was good engagement with the Department of Labor, and it died down at some point. At this point, is not at its best, Madam Chair, I must say. We will wish to have a better engagement with the department because we had found that with constant engagement, we could do a lot of things together. So there's quite a bit of lull, and it could be, I believe, lost of institutional knowledge in terms of why there were these relationships. So I think we'll want to ask the committee to also maybe insist on the department that they should try to engage more. So I think we're involved in the first process of sectoral determination. I think we're very supportive. Like I'm saying, we act as a representative of the workers also, so we do our best to try to actually represent their interest. the difficulty in the taxi industry is that a taxi driver is not purely a worker, he's almost a shareholder in the taxi business. I'll tell you why he's a shareholder. He keeps some of the money. The taxi driver keeps cash in his pocket, and he literally pays the owner of the taxi a certain amount in a day. And what we found, some days the driver keeps more money than the owner. So we're not sure who's employing who in this relationship. You'll see when we did some calculation in terms of how we're performing in terms of the sectoral determination. So there's that relationship. Now, in terms of, are we doing very well in terms of all conditions of employment? Not at all. And I think it's one of the submissions we want to make to the committee that we are pleading for assistance in this space, for support. We're doing training, but I think some of our members mostly have their drivers on UIF and other of these products, but some do not have because they don't understand. So I think we want to implore the department and the committee to maybe engage with us to see if we can't be supported in one way or another to ensure that we remain compliant. But I must say up front, there's a willingness on our side to be compliant, and we're willing to be helped in that space. We in no way claiming to be experts in labor issues, and therefore we submit ourselves to whatever assistance we can actually get. But I think at least there's willingness on our part to be compliant. If we look at the slide, the last point, we were in the process of trying to transform the payment of fares within the taxi industry. Currently it's cash, and you can imagine with the number of taxis, so millions of rand of cash are moving around every morning and every afternoon. We want to put an electronic system in place. As part of that process, we have done some pilots, and I think when we were collecting the money using an electronic system, we saw that there's been leakages of about 30 to 40%, and that's why I'm saying the driver is definitely a shareholder. He's maybe a 30% shareholder in the business. They've been keeping some of the money, so I think there are those dynamics that when we get to a point of determining what is a reasonable minimum wage in the taxi industry, for example, we'll have to consider how do we manage that a situation. I'm sure this is public information. The current sectoral determination in terms of wages for drivers, for example, is 2,847. And there's different categories, but I'll look at a driver because it's one of the major parts of the employment group. And I think it will be adjusted using CPIX, et cetera, in the next period. So in any instance, you can look at it and say it's about 3,000 rand that a driver should be paid. But currently, drivers mostly are paid about 3,005 to 4,005. So owners will pay drivers. So we are currently higher than the sectoral determination as it stands. So the owner will pay a driver. So the driver weekly will get a payment, and I think in some instances it's 3.5 minimum to 4,500. But however, drivers also take double income because they also keep some of the money. So we estimate a driver takes home about 7,000 or more on a monthly basis. Excluding money it takes for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And in some instances, he doesn't drive alone. He has a friend that he drives with, mostly a female friend, and who also benefits from this dinner, breakfast, and lunch. So there are those calculations. So we believe at this point it's about 250% of compliance in terms of the sectoral determination. And again, I must admit, it was very simple calculations we did. They are not scientific. They are not intelligent. It was just calculations from what we know. So, yes, indeed, we lack in some areas, but I think we're not bad payers, Madam Chair. I've said again, we're saying we need collaboration in the space of various aspects of this labor relations, and we are open to engaging with the department and other agencies of the Department of Labor to see that we're fully compliant. What we would want to say, Madam Chair, is that as much as we support as the principle the issue of minimum wage, but we believe that it should be done selectively, and I think there should be a direct consultation with various stakeholders around how it should be implemented. I believe that, I mean, the committee has a very intricate task here, and I think it's all economic questions are very difficult, because if not, we wouldn't be in this challenge we're in around the world, because economists would have designed the very best economic policy and we'll all be well off. But I mean, it's a number of combination of factors, and that's why, despite the best economists we have or the world over, there's still economic challenges around the world. Now, we know that the committee wants to balance between issues of inequality. We know we've got the highest rate of inequality in our country. There's issues of poverty. There's issues of unemployment. I mean, 26% is quite high. So I think when we were here last week, Madam Chair, we observed that. I think for me, it's a very unfortunate situation where business or employers and labor have a very antagonistic relationship. And I said in Rush last week that maybe when we walked out of that chamber, some groups felt they might have won the debate. But I think the biggest loser was the debate itself, because we might have missed quite a number of inputs that would be valuable in structuring a proper national minimum wage. Because unfortunately, economics are straightforward. There's demand and supply. There's a cost of production, and if you raise it, it raises the price. And I think it will be a combination of balancing factors, Madam Chair, because if cost of production are going high, goods will be expensive. Those who are buying goods will import them from China and elsewhere where they are cheap. So as we implement this minimum wage, Madam Chair, I think we'll also need to say, how do you deal with import parity so that if people decide to buy from outside, when the things land here and they are sold on the floor, they must be equitable to what has been produced locally. Otherwise, we'll continuously create a situation where we remain consumers and we lose jobs in the country. Another important point is about how we deal with the 26% or 25.5% of unemployment. And labor will argue, and correctly so, that workers must be paid and not be abused. But if you go around, you look at a person who's been unemployed for the past 5 years and ask him how much you want to be paid, you'll get a different story. And so if you do simple calculations, if a person is paid the 2,000 rand, Madam Chair, but is the only breadwinner in the family of seven, that 2,000 might not go very far. But if three of them are employed at 1,005, you've got a bigger income in that family. So I think, and I know it's a very challenging debate, what is the best model? You look at the issues of crime, Madam Chair, until we've got more people employed in this country, we'll always live in an unsafe environment. And I think it's not nice for all of us. Crime is taking a different shape. People are starting to rob malls on broad daylight. They don't wait for you to leave your house. They walk in while we are there and rob you. And I think the situation is getting dire. So I think all these balancing factors, and I think I wish, and I think my colleagues from Labour, we must say we're a progressive organization. We are aligned to the left. But we want to say to business and labor, we need to find a proper dialogue. I think we can't have a confrontational relationship, because I think we're missing each other when we can work together to maybe resolve problems of this country. And I think also business must come on the table. I mean, it can't maximize profits at the expense of the workers. But I think shareholders don't really care. They want the best output out of their investment. And so those are the challenges. And I think, Madam Chair, we hope that the committee will balance all these factors and maybe come with a reasonable output. We certainly want to be consulted once that decision has been taken in terms of, because I think we believe where conditions are different in our industry, so we'll want to maybe negotiate to a point where it's something that is sustainable, because we wouldn't want to lose any job, but we'll want to maintain the jobs we have and maybe grow the taxi industry itself. So we'll want to keep salaries where we can be able to afford them. And I think, like I'm saying, we are happy that we're one of the best paying industries, as it will. Madam Chair, I think that's all we wanted to possibly share with this committee, and definitely wish the committee the best. We know you've got quite a lot of work to do in getting this right. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much, Sandako, for the detailed report or presentation. I will give over to the members and the guests to say something on the presentation. The first hand is Mr. Bahrain, Honorable Bahrain. Honorable Hollis Moteka. Okay, let me take those three.
Madam Chair, may I go ahead and ask my question? Thank you. Thank you, sir. Thank you for the report and the presentation. We appreciate it. I'm looking in particular at your presentation where you tell us that the minimum wage is not easy to implement due to a whole lot of issues, and I certainly understand that. In fact, I would suggest that this is an issue that would be for many industries that pay in commission and that have a lot of shrinkage. You call it leakage. I call it theft. And you see that across many industries. And what we do know is that there is, in fact, a minimum wage for your industry already. And you proudly tell us you're paying beyond that and people are taking beyond that in any event. Do you not think it is a lot easier to have the minimum wage in your industry specifically designed for your industry as opposed to across the board?
Is that the only question?
Thank you. Yes,
okay.
I'm looking at
Honorable Lollis.
Thank you, Chairman. It's Mr. Buthelezi, isn't it? Okay. So thank you for your presentation. It was very helpful. And I think I agree with you that the best solution in South Africa is always dialogue and coming to a position after hearing all different sides of the debate. So I think I really appreciate that. I know your industry is very important. Apartheid has left us with a legacy of people living very far from work and very far from amenities, and I think your industry is one of the key industries that helps in a little way at least to bridge that gap by all of the work that your members do. So I think you do very important work, and I think that government should support you as a public transport entity. And I think I used to be on the on the Transport Committee. I think they are investigating that. I don't know how far they are, but when I was on the Transport Committee, they were already discussing what to do about that. I'm not sure what the conclusion is. In terms of your presentation, I just have 2 points. We had a UCT presentation when we started this process that comes from a lot of research that they did into the question of minimum wages, and they showed some of the differences between different industries. In agriculture, there were certain effects. People lost jobs when they put the minimum wage. In other industries, there weren't serious effects when the minimum wage for that industry was implemented. Could you just, in that research, one of the points they made was in the taxi industry, there wasn't a lot of unemployment that happened as a result of putting in the minimum wage. Roughly the same number of people were employed before or after the minimum wage. They are ever asked the question whether perhaps some people were working shorter hours for the same money, because when the minimum wage came in, there might have been one or two people that weren't paid at that level. Because you don't only employ taxi drivers, you also have marshals, queue marshals, and other staff, officials, and so on. Could you maybe just give us your view? Did you see a change in employment patterns after the minimum wage? Was there any impact that you were aware of? And then my second question is, in the mining industry, we saw that they're wanting a minimum wage of 12,500 per month. What would be the effect on your industry if that became a national minimum wage across the whole country? Something like that. What would be the effect if there was that kind of minimum wage? And then my colleague covered the other question I wanted to ask, so I won't ask it again. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Olusegun Obatek.
Thank you, Chair. I've got one question and comment. My question is, when will the process of electronic collector be finished? Because I think that is the key thing that will help this committee to determine how much is the taxi industry making per month and all that. And that will help us at the end when we make decisions to determine, to decide how much is the level that taxi industry can sustainably afford in a long term. Because what they are telling us here is very difficult. Things of taxi owner and taxi driver, both shareholders, because the other one is going dry clean, the other one has got girlfriends going with, they're not going to help us. We want to know how much is the accurate amount, how much is the taxi industry making? Because that is the figure that will help the committee to decide. Because our aim is not to kill the industry, and our aim also is to protect the employees in the industry. So I think the quicker you done this electronic collection machinery, the better. And if to me, if it was my view, Chair, we are going to say let us give them time frame so that we know by when it will be done. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. Chair, I'm looking at that slide which is saying minimum wage is not easy to implement, just like my colleague. And I'm comparing it with that slide which is saying drivers are paid on average 3.5 per month. I then get confused because I'm not sure whether your drivers are permanently employed or they are employed as casuals. And also, can you come out clearly? Let us not assume that Santaco seems not to be supporting the notion of a minimum wage. Mm. Are we reading that correctly when we say that? Also, why would you want collaboration for you to comply with the pieces of legislation? because there's a slide where you are saying you request a collaboration so that you can be able to implement the pieces of legislation. Is it not negligence when you don't implement what you know? Instead, you request collaboration. Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Lulu, Honorable Lemon Natasha.
Thank you. The whip has covered me, Chair, on the questions I wanted to raise.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. I just want to understand, first, SANTACO. Is SANTACO an employer organization? Do they recognize their members as employers? Does those employers, if their employers pay UIF? Because I think to actually understand whether they are employers, one can actually have a view. And I also concur that they must also come clear if they are in support of the national minimum wage.
Honorable Lamerica.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My colleague on the far left, right, has partly covered what I was going to ask, but I'll ask it nevertheless. I'd like to know, thank you, Mr. Butlezi, for the insightful presentation. I want to know whether we have a sector minimum wage and occupation specific within the sector, how would that, if it is above what is now currently the norm, how would it impact upon your industry in particular? And then lastly, just a comment, I like the closing remarks of you, Mr. Butlezi, in terms of sometimes we have a default bias towards the elite that are employed, but we forget about over 8 million people out there who are not employed, who constitutes about 36% of our employable population. So therefore, one has to have a balanced approach and make sure we bring more people into the employment environment than, protecting the few that's already employed. Thank you, sir.
I will give over to... Were there hands on the set? Oh, okay.
Okay, my name is Mohammed. I'm from Namusa. I just want to compliment Mr. Budalesi for the very good presentation. I just want to ask, in determining the minimum wages or salaries for the employees in the taxi industry, what formula was used in determining that? Because I think that's quite critical in the debate, because we hear constantly from people that it's arguing against the minimum wage, that it will cause more job losses, notwithstanding the fact that they tend to support the notion that the minimum wage is going to even be higher than what is currently paid in certain sectors, and that will cause job losses. And they're doing that in a vacuum of determining from government what formula is going to be used. And if a correct formula is used, certainly it cannot put the minimum rate above what certain sectors are already paying, and therefore it will not necessarily result in job losses. As we said last week, we're speaking about the vulnerable groups, and we're speaking about those that are not organized and unorganized, and that are exploited with wages below the poverty levels that causes the high inequalities that we're sitting with, that causes the crime that we're sitting with. So I just want to ask that question in terms of the formula and taking consideration, and it's already mentioned that after setting that minimum wage, there was no job losses. So I think the formula used is important for our discussion and debate.
Okay. Do you want to say something? Okay. over to you, Mr. Tilili.
Okay. No, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the various speakers with their various questions. Maybe let me deal with the major question, whether are we in support of the national minimum wage or not, because I think that's the crux of the matter. We're definitely in support of the national minimum wage. However, our view that is not a yes or no question. There's quite a number of things to be considered, and that's why in our presentation we address quite a number of things that has to be considered. Indeed, there's a cost of living in South Africa. So I think we need to be saying, does working for a person make sense or not? Because if working does not make sense, you might as well not work. Because if it costs you 50% to travel and other costs, and eventually you are left with 10% of what you earned, it's not gainful employment. So I think there is merit to have a minimum wage, but it should be set at a level. And that's why it won't be a yes or no question, but we need a formula that will say this is the base, but per industry, this is what can be added on. These are the variations that can be put per various industries. Indeed, the question is whether should it be industry-based or sector-based. Like the sectoral determination, it has been sector-based, depending on the dynamics of that particular sector.
Mm-hmm.
But at least I think the argument is that let's have a base that everyone can then work from, can add, or at least we have a minimum that says the cost of living in South Africa per day is X rents or per month, and everyone must at least work to that level. Otherwise, there's no point in doing work. There's no encouragement for productivity. People who are unemployed are even better because they don't have to waste time and soap. They can just live the whole day. So I think we need to encourage people to work, but there should be a base where we're starting from. And I think what we're saying, the base must be done such that it's not high, that is not sustainable, because then we would have wasted time implementing the minimum wage. So I think to answer the other question about whether it should be industry-based, no, we're saying there should be a base, but then per industry will make submissions in terms of what is reasonable, because other industries can afford more, others less. And again, I think our view is that there's a lot of excuses we can use not to pay any cent more as a tax industry. But I think we don't want to take the debate there. I think we want to say, let's determine what the nation feels is reasonable, and then let's look at factors that are impacting on our industry, and we can come to a reasonable wage. But I think we want to believe that we have done well so far, and I think we should be able to meet some of those requirements. When the sectoral determination was implemented, yes, correctly, we have not lost jobs. And in fact, if the industry was subsidized and people were working the right number of hours, we could create even more jobs. But as you know, a driver would start work at 4 a.m., he knocks off at 9. I think that is... But in between, there's also quiet time, so he's got time off during the day. But he can't take another job. So I think we need to find a way of how do we literally double the amount of jobs within the tax industry if we had subsidies, because then people could work a specific number of hours and then have shifts that will actually work. And I think naturally, as the industry evolved, the method of determining wages also evolved with the tax industry. And I think it was not a very scientific calculation, but it has worked over years. So natural wisdom worked, because the owner will know that he owes so much in this taxi, and this is what he wants to take home. And I think they then had a number of taxis, so combined those factors and said, for example, in most cases, a driver will be asked to bring in a day 300 or 500 rand, and the balance of whatever he does goes to his pocket. So that's why we're saying it's not really a theft in some instances. It's how the business model has been designed, that it works and benefit within this particular system. But I think a sustainable industry will want to have a formal employment process, salaries, medical aid, etc., so that even the lives of drivers actually improved or queue marshals and people are working within this environment. So that's why we're saying, Madam Chair, that we need support in those areas. We did a study 18 months ago in terms of fares within the taxi space. I think we were concerned that every time petrol goes up, our members will just raise taxi fares with 50 cents, 1 rand. But there was no scientific method around that. So we sat down and developed what we call the taxi fare index. So we took all the cost of running this business. We said, what does it cost? Financing cost, labor cost, licensing, et cetera, fuel, which is a major cost. And you combine them and you came with an index that says if it's 100 basis, if there's a change in fuel, how much does it impact? Is it a 5% increase? And I think we then communicate that every time there's a change in that index. So at least we limit the increases to a reasonable level when fuel goes down. So we do it over a period of time so that we do not change too frequent, because salaries don't change like that. They change annually. So you can't raise your fares every month because people will eventually not afford the taxi fares. So and I think that tells us from a labor point of view, really, we believe we've been able to actually pay what is reasonable. We indeed hoping that if subsidy kicks in, we really pose to be a better industry, and I mean, I think a better paying industry than what we are. And yes, there was a question whether our members are paying UIF. Yes, we're employers, we pay UIF. And I must say it's not 100%. There are cases. So two things we do. We pay UIF, we pay tax. People always believe taxi operators do not pay tax. To get an operating license or to renew it or to engage with the Department of Transport, one of the things they demand is a tax clearance.
Mm-hmm.
So our members do comply in that level because they are asked all the time to submit a tax clearance showing that they are tax compliant. Others do creative tax management, which is allowable in law, but we do pay tax to the extent that the law allows. And as part of that, we pay UIF. But I'm saying we're not at a level where one can say our compliance to labor relations or labor matters is at 100%. Maybe at 70%, there's a space for, and that's why we need support. We need support because our resources are limited. I mean, he's an individual taxi operator. He can't contribute money towards his skills development or capacitating operators to understand that they must pay UIF for their employees. So I think there's a huge capacity building exercise that is required, and I think we rely on government to play that role to help us to be compliant. At least we're there to provide the support. Madam Chair, I don't know whether I've missed any of the questions. But just to add, I think the point about having a formula to actually work this out, I think definitely we have to engage with the best minds we have in the country, the economists, to sit and work on various formulas. And I'm sure the committee might also explore study tours to various countries. I know, for example, in China, they have a national minimum wage, but it's not applied nationally. Is applied per, so in the South African scenario, it will be per local government or provincial government, because different provinces in China have different challenges. So there is that allowance to have a national wage, but you apply it according to the different sectors. But again, I think the point is we'll have to balance all these things. We can't do one side and kill the. It's like in a war, Madam Chair, there's different backings, and I think we'll have to fight all of them to win this war. And I think we need to make sure that we balance our decisions with various issues.
Is it a follow-up? Because I want to take new hands. Your question. Oh, okay. His question, you remember there was a question from Mr. Ollis that they did not lose jobs.
Chairperson, yes. He answered the question about the fact that the jobs weren't lost, But the second part was, did you see any change? Like, did the queue marshals have to work longer hours to get the money, or shorter hours to get the money? Was there any change that you noticed when the minimum wage came in? And then my second question was the 12.5, which the mine workers have been demanding. What would be the effect on your industry if we set it at 12.5?
Maybe let me start with the first one, whether were there any changes in terms of hours of work when we implemented. No, there were not. Unfortunately for our country operates from morning to early evening when it dies. So definitely, if we're a queue marshal, your hours will always be limited to operational hours. So there was not a change at all, and drivers continued. So fortunately for us, when this was done, we were already above the minimum wage that was actually determined. So I think there was no major impact around the conditions of employment. Like I said, but we believe they're not at their best. They could be improved. Working conditions in taxi ranks are very poor, and unfortunately it's not our area of expertise. Is the municipalities, they need to build better facilities, but taxi ranks are in the West States. They're filthy. It's unbelievable that people are expected to work and live there. So I think some of the problems, Madam Chair, that might not belong to this committee, but that as government we need to be asking that 15 million people pass through these taxi facilities that are of very poor state and quality, and I think it's an indictment to those. Will the industry cope with 12.5? I wouldn't want to answer it and say no. Oh yes, we'll have to look at the figures, but it's way too high from what I've actually presented, which we believe drivers are taking. So if we're to part with the fact that they're taking 3.5 and more, there was a question whether when the electronic system will actually come into effect. And indeed, we agree that will give us even a better understanding of these dynamics. We've been working on the project for a couple of years. It requires quite a lot of investment, and we're engaging a number of potential investors. And I think it's not, I can't give you a timeline, but we're making progress. We believe we'll find a good investor to come in. Your challenge is that once you implement the system, you can't do it bit by bit. You must put it in. Otherwise, if somebody comes with cash, another one with a card, it becomes a confused environment. So I think we'll have to determine what is reasonable, and I think we can't answer it here, Madam Chair. It will be determined in terms of what really becomes the national minimum wage, and then we can work around those figures.
Honourable, this 12.5 question, were you asking if it were to be the national minimum wage, or if it were to be introduced in this industry? In just clarity, so that I can make sense with this answer.
Sure. Chairperson, it actually doesn't matter whether it's the one or the other one, because it's the same thing. So whether it's a 12.5 for his industry or whether it's a 12.5 national minimum wage, I just wanted to know if the industry could cope with that number, because I know in the mine industry the workers have been asking for that number. So I'm just wondering if that becomes the national minimum wage, whether the taxi industry will cope with that. And if you look at the figures he shared, they're quite below that. And I think his answer is it will be difficult. So I'm covered. I think he answered the question. Thank you.
Any questions that are not answered before I open another round? Okay. One, two, three, four. You'll be the fifth one. I'm on another round. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for this opportunity. George Warrington for producer. Mr. Sanko, what I would like to know from your side, you were talking about average salary. Now, I would have thought that you would have a fixed one salary going through for the driver as its job description is basically the same. Can you please explain why it would be actually an average salary across the board? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Warren. No, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Firstly, one needs to appreciate the presentation made by Santaco, which have looked at various factors that affect South Africans, and also alluding to the fact that there are imbalances in terms of supporting the industry, which I think that is based on government playing a major role. For instance, having Gautrain that is supporting people that who are already advanced in terms of the economy in this country. This comes back to what we have even here, we had here in Cape Town, in the Western Cape, where you would have your BRT buses from Tableview, while you have got a bulk of people who are very far from the places of work and who are so impoverished, staying in Khayelitsha, in Makasa, in Strand. And this alone indicates the imbalances that we have. And I think Mr. Buthelezi put it clear that in order to, in as much as they are supporting the national minimum wage, which are the first employers to come out, support this national minimum wage, in as much as they have got these challenges that they think that if they are addressed and they are willing to have a dialogue, willing to engage and sit and ensure that with government they can emerge with a solution to the challenges that they have. For me, I feel so much impressed now for the first time, because in the previous presentations we were having organizations that were directly opposite to mean opposed to the initiative by government to explore for this minimum wage. It's one thing that I think is important that we appreciate from the this employer organization. Secondly, I think that we must emphasize not that we have interest, that this organization has got a good vision, not for only itself, but for the country at large. To visualize yourself as establishing an industry that would be manufacturing taxes. For us, it's not that we have interest because we are NUMSA. We know that it's job creation, and that's where our members would be. And we think that government have really a role to play in supporting this organization. I think for now, I must just end there, Madam Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Lufila from NUMSA. The gentleman over there.
Okay, morning, Chairperson. Thanks very much. My name is Matthew Parks from COSATU. Just a few comments and questions, Chairperson. I think firstly to agree with Santaco that the taxi industry is a very strategic industry. It plays a critical role in society. Without it, the economy simply cannot function. I think they're right that they have a very difficult task competing with the bus industry, the rail industry, which receives significant subsidies from the state. The government will need to look at that. Having said that, Chair, I think part of the problems in the taxi industry about pilferage, to use that term, or leakages, it might be that one is that often owners want a daily commission from the drivers, irregardless of how many passengers the driver might have been able to transport that date. Two is that, of course, the subsidies from the bus industry. I think that's why you see high levels of lawlessness in the taxi industry itself. And often you find owners themselves are also involved in illegal criminal activity on the side. from drug dealing and so forth. I think, Chair, it would be interesting to hear from Santako about the conditions of the drivers and the guardsheets or the security guards. Do they really enjoy the full benefits of the LRA? Do they get overtime? Do they get time off? Not just time off to sit under the tree for 2 hours at lunchtime, but proper time off, pension, safety conditions. Because if one takes the hours mentioned by Mr. Buthelezi from 4 a.m. to 9 p.m., 6 days a week, for example, then you've already exceeded by far the 10-hour weekly limit on overtime. Because that sounds about 58 hours overtime in a week, easily. I think, Chair, it would also be interesting from David Santako, but do they know the extent of compliance within the sector? I know it's a very difficult sector to monitor, but what's the extent of the compliance with the different aspects of the labor legislation? The last two things, Chair, I think, is that just off-the-cuff comments from the honorable members. I'm not sure if we can say those people who are working, if they're really an elite. You know, if you're a domestic worker earning 2,000 rand, or if you're a taxi driver earning 3,500, I'm not sure that's the proper definition of the term elite. Elite might be rather more useful to refer to a mining boss earning 45 million rand in a year. And I think that's part of the reason why you see mine workers then demanding a 12,500, because they see the CEO of the same company earning 40 million, or the CEO of APSA earning 33 million in the same year. And of course, Chair, obviously all workers have the right to protection. It's not an illegitimate right to ask to be protected. And we know the labor rights afforded to workers in South Africa are, to be honest, very, very basic. They're not unreasonable or extreme. I think lastly, Comrade Chair, why we're supporting this COSATU, a national minimum wage, is that it's to uplift workers out of poverty. It's not to be used to suppress wage levels. Because one gets a fear that you might find, as you go further down the road in the debate, some bosses may want to use it. Well, the national minimum wage is here. We're paying you too high. Let's push your wages down. Or we will not give you an increase until you are at the same level. So it's a two-edged sword, Chair. We know that. It's a very complicated debate, but that's why we appreciate the committee opening up this debate for all participants. Thanks, Chairperson.
Thank you, Mr. Pop. Can I see you there?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Nkosazana from NUM. Mine is simple. I would like Mr. Buthelezi has told us that the taxi drivers are part shareholders in the industry. Mine would be, would it be that the money that they are taking that you don't know of is to certify their wage that they're not satisfied with? And then would it be fair if you regulate that to make it a share? For instance, in the mining industry, they've got a share employee stock ownership share plan, of which that then gives the employees the benefit of what the company made out of the annually. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Motheka.
Thanks, Chair. I think Santako need to be commended for not being anti minimum wage implementation. The fact that they support it, because how much will be determined by the research later on. But for the fact that they support it shows not all capital groups anti-transformation. So I think they must be commended. Obviously, those anti-groups will try to convince or influence each and everyone that is in the business industry to be against this thing. That's why an issue of 12,000, 5,000 is coming in. It is very irrelevant. No one has ever called for 12,500 across the board. No one. That thing, that figure was broken in the mining industry and it ended there. I don't remember anyone talking of
domestic workers, this industry, what and all that. So we let us not try to confuse each other so that we can try to make others anti, then the anti group can be empowered. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. With regards to the implementation of the sectoral domination in this sector, you would see when you presented on the current compliance levels, you are focusing on the drivers, and we know it's extremely difficult to monitor the sector, but I'm interested in the other job categories, because we know that the drivers, they are having the money in their hand. But if we look at for instance, your admin, your rank marshals, and the other vulnerable workers, we're not getting any indication on what's happening on that front. But also you indicated that it's somehow difficult to fully implement the sectoral determination. Would you say that it is in some instances difficult to comply just for the sake of doesn't want to comply, or because of the fact that the employers can't keep up with the current sectoral determination? And do you have any statistics or anything available in terms of the employers that who ask for exemption from the sectoral determination? Thank you, Chairperson.
Okay. No, thank you, Chair. There was a question why drivers are paid at different, and I think it's purely the taxi industry, or how the business model was designed, is really an entrepreneurial business. So it was really based on in what area they were at the time and what were the cost of living. And indeed, if you look at different wages, you'll have to look at what you pay people in rural areas versus urban areas, and purely because of the cost of living, because you can't pay the same salary everywhere, depending where they are. So those are the dynamics that we faced within the taxi industry itself. Some routes are very lucrative. They might be shorter, so the driver doesn't drive long, but it's lucrative. He gets paid more in that route because the owner makes more money, so they can share more. In some routes, it's very poor. The car drives only twice a week. And again, so there are those dynamics. So you can't pay a flat salary right across. But I mean, I think in different cases, they've been able to find a way that it works, and that's why people still work in the taxi industry. And I know there's always a perception that being a taxi driver is the worst job, and we've seen that people who come to drive taxis, they say, I'm going to drive for a week or a month and then get a job. 20 years down the line, they're still driving the taxi because it's workable. He makes a living. So it's not as bad as it is, yet we want to improve the job itself so that even people who finish school might see driving a taxi or a public transport vehicle as a employment choice or as a career, not just as the worst thing to do in life. In terms of condition of employment, it's correct, and I think we have actually admitted in our presentation, we are far from being fully compliant. There's many areas that we have not done very well, and I think we've got a job around, and that's why we're looking at partnerships around this space, on how we can be assisted to be fully compliant. So levels of compliance, I mean, they differ from association to association, from operations. Mostly, in the past, we have an industry of people that were not well educated, and I think that's why we applaud tax owners, that they're able to build such a big business, some with very less education levels. The industry is turning around. We see younger people getting into the leadership positions, running associations. So levels of education are getting higher and higher every year. So I think we're seeing a lot of improvements and better understanding So that's why we need support, because somebody out there does not understand why, what is UIF in the first place? Why should it be paid? So there are those challenges within the industry that we are still facing, but they are improving as we are going along. But I'm sure I know the debate is about national minimum wage, but maybe we need to be asking ourselves when you want to look at inequality, whether there shouldn't be a national maximum wage that says in a country like ours, it's unreasonable for a person to be paid 15 million per annum when there's a person who earns 100,000 per annum. So maybe when we deal with inequality, I think why we have the highest inequality, maybe we are comparing wrong numbers. We're looking at the bottom end of the economy. And when the calculation of the inequality is done, and you put, there's a huge gap between people who are earning good salaries and millions of those who are earning bad salaries. And I think maybe it could be a debate that in a country like ours, it's maybe, and I'm sure those who are earning good salaries will not like me for this comment, because people will want to maximize what they can earn. But I think there's a huge gap between, and I think that's why we've got these fights about why, if a person can earn 20 million per annum, and you still say the company cannot afford to pay others. I think it creates a problem. It creates a problem for business to justify why they can't do better, why they can't pay more when they're able to pay the top end of the business high. So I think maybe the debate must be extended at some point to look at, in a poor country like ours, with the level of economic growth, is it reasonable to pay such huge salaries? I don't like the debate myself because I want more money, but maybe we'll have to take those hard decisions, all of us, for a certain period. It could be a freeze over a period that, so that you can get the economy to the right levels before we can go back to. And that's why I think this is a government intervention to a normal economic equation. And I think you can't intervene in one level; you must intervene everywhere to get this thing controlled. And I think my lovely lady asked a question about whether drivers are shareholders. And I think it's not a formal environment, but I'm saying in terms of how the operation works, they indeed are taking a share of the business. What we'll want to do in future is to formalize it so that they become, there's a share scheme within the taxi industry, they can own shares. Because, and it does not affect only drivers, even taxi owners. We see most of them, they don't leave a legacy, or they don't create wealth. They work when they're old, they have nothing. And that's why we see very old drivers. A person was the owner of the taxi and eventually ends up driving for someone younger. So there are those things that we still need to fix as an industry, to say how do we build wealth and assets within the industry so that people can pass them on from generation to generation. So there are those dimensions that we need to look at. How the other workers, like your queue marshals, the cleaners, we have not done a detailed study in terms of what they are earning. We know what associations pay them because they're paid by the associations that are operating within that taxi rank, for example. But I mean, we see most of them, there's very low turnover, so they stay in these jobs. So they're making some reasonable income. But indeed, I think it's an area that one might want to look. What I can say safely is that we're above the sectoral determination, even in those spaces. But again, the conditions are not good. So I think there's merit, honourable member, to actually look at how we can actually work with that. And then, like I said, I think in terms of compliance, we really are saying we are not fully compliant. And in some cases, it's just an administrative thing that people do not know what they need to do. Some don't see it as important. And I think as an organization, we do the best we can to educate, and that's why we want to work with Labour, UIF, and other bodies to go on the ground and educate members that it's important for a driver to have a UIF, because when it passes on, there's intervention that comes through from government, etc. So yeah, there's a lot of work to be done in the taxi industry, like any other sector. But I think we're working through it. Fortunately, we are conscious of these problems. So at least we know there are these challenges, and we deal with them year after year. Madam Chair, again, I will not claim this is a good research, but it's just a desktop research we did. We looked at unemployment, and we took countries within the BRICS fold. South Africa is at 26%, China 4.1 roughly, India at 5.2, Brazil at 4.9. Now, China and Brazil, they've got a national minimum wage, and they've got a low unemployment rate. So again, it argues with the debate whether minimum wage will increase unemployment or so again, there's an argument that if you have a minimum wage, you might create unemployment. But I'm saying in other countries that have the lowest unemployment, they've got a national minimum wage. So again, we'll need to do a detailed analysis on that. These countries with minimum wage, for example, China has a 7.4 economic growth. We have 2%, and yet we don't have. So again, I think India is a 5.7. Okay, Brazil is a 2.5. But I think China and India have the highest economic growth, yet low unemployment. And I think, Madam Chair, that's what I was saying. You know, this economic formulas are very complex, and it will be difficult to find the right formula, and therefore it will be a very interesting job for you. But yeah, I think we trust the committee will find the right answer.
Thank you. Any question that has not been answered? No. Thank you so much, Mr. Buthelezi, from SANTACO. We had a fruitful discussion. All these discussions are recorded, and as we go forward to compile our reports and investigating what is that the product should be at the end of the day, we now and again remind ourselves of what has been said by various stakeholders. So we will thank you so much, and thank you for your patience to be back again here. Now we will give over to Professor I'm very bad with the pronunciation of names. Professor Renkin from from Stellenbosch, and okay, can we take 3 minutes comfort break while the session after?
Yeah, right, I can do that.